Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Oh, hello. It's Thursday, and it's time to welcome you to Waypoints, where the Waypoint staff and friends take a break to nerd out and deep dive on the culture, art, and entertainment that's been inspiring and provoking us lately. Gathered around the table this Thursday, we've got Patrick Klopik.
Hello.
Danielle Riendeau.
Hi.
Austin Walker.
Hello.
Natalie Watson.
Hey.
He did it.
Wait, I didn't even catch it. I didn't even notice that he did it.
It was unnaturally.
We're going to be talking about a couple horror themed. Where you know it's the holiday season.
It's Thanksgiving.
People are going to be spending spending weeks at their childhood homes. And for some of us, this is a magical time. For some of us, maybe less magical. And it's a time to consider various forms of horror and creepy stories and the demons that haunt us all.
Don't go in the basement, no matter what.
Don't go in the basement.
When you
go
home,
don't go in the house.
Basements.
Do it.
I wish I
unless
had
it's
a basement.
Been renovated in
yeah,
within
what if it's
the last
cozy?
20 years. Carpets? I never had that, but I went to some friends' houses that had really cool renovated basements, and I always wish mine looked like that.
Did they, though, or were they just all, like, fucking, like, middle-aged man cave type things? That's all, like, if my friends had, like, nicely finished basements, almost certainly it was like, I got a wet bar back here. And I was like, I don't know if that's cool.
One of my friends had a bowling alley in her basement.
What?
Wow.
Wait,
you know,
what?
Sometimes I forget that our upbringings were very different. But then, like, you just say something, and, like, a lot of
it wasn't me. I just had access. I got insider access. It wasn't me, though. Mm-hmm.
Did you have a pool?
No.
Okay.
My parents were very afraid of me and my brother falling in the pool.
That's smart.
And something happening to us, so we never
very
got
wise.
A pool. I'm also a... All of us are terrible swimmers, my entire family. So we weren't pool people.
I just didn't know people in LA have pools.
Oh,
like
everyone has
a
pool.
Okay.
But I didn't. I was like one of the only ones.
That's okay then. Just go to your friend's pool.
Yeah. I didn't have to worry about the upkeep.
Yeah. True.
You know?
Fair.
Yeah, that's true. Like, everyone who had a pool, like, half the year, it was like, oh, you can't swim in the pool. Like, sorry, I fucked up, and there's algae.
Sorry, there's, yeah.
Sorry, your skin will be bleached off your bones.
There's a biome in there.
Yeah. All right, so to start us out here, Danielle, let's dig into your waypoint. You've been excited about this one for a couple weeks.
Yeah.
This is a show you referred to a few times, but I gather that the show's gone from a few good seasons to like a truly great one here in its fourth. And we're going to be talking about Channel Zero, The Dream Door.
Yes.
Why don't you set the stage for us a little bit there?
Okay. And well, first of all, I will say it's between 2 and 4 for me as the greatest season of this series. It's an anthology series on Sci-Fi. So every season is its own sort of contained story. And interestingly, they all have different numbers of episodes, I think. I think some of them have 6, some of them have 5, some of them have like 8 or 9 episodes, which I think is cool because it's like, oh yeah, the season's length actually sort of fits the story in a good way. So the first season, just briefly I'll set up, the first season was Candle Cove, and it was about a sort of evil pirate TV show that only a bunch of kids who grew up in a certain area remembered. And none of their parents had ever seen it, and it went off the rails. I think it was probably the least successful.
What if Shazam killed people?
I mean, it's actually a little stupider than that. Like, what actually ends up happening is,
okay,
you know. But there was a lot there. The second season, which again, between 2 and 4, I think are the absolute greatest, amazing distillations of not only like a really great horror series, but horror specifically sort of targeted towards a female protagonist. Really, really awesome. That was called No End House, and it was premised on both grief and trauma sort of as a subtext, but it was premised on an extreme haunted house that actually was a portal to another dimension. And there was a whole bunch of shit going on there, and it was incredible, and it had a lot to say about sort of family and trauma and dealing with trauma, processing trauma. The third season, Butcher's Block, actually had Rutger Hauer as a weird demon man who eats people, which was awesome and great. Good, but maybe a little more uneven than this season, which is about a woman whose name is Jill, who is a landscape architect. And importantly, she's a woman of color. This is one of the things that we will talk about, I think, probably quite a bit. Horror has a real problem with this. Not a ton of protagonists of color, which is shitty and an issue. Although I know today we're talking about two different horror pieces that have protagonists of color, which is pretty cool. She's a woman of color. She and her husband have moved into a new house. And there's a door. There's a secret door in the basement. There's also I guess it starts out being the villain. There is a contortionist mime whose face is sort of half melted. His name is Pretzel Jack, and he kills people. So this season is very, very, very much about also processing trauma. It's also about fear, and it has a lot of interesting subtext about without kind of... I don't know how much we want to go into spoiler territory too much, but I can be kind of vague in the way that it is very much about sort of the things that we create to protect ourselves. It's very much about having very specific fears about family and sort of family trauma and losing a parent or a parent leaving you at a very young age and the kinds of things that we make up to make ourselves feel better. It also has a lot of subtext about sort of reproduction and making things and sort of how we make things. Do we make them well? Do we make them with love? Do we kind of fuck up and create sort of half-formed beings and creatures and other sort of ways to deal with things? That has a lot of subtext about sort of mental health and mental illness, which I think was very interesting. But yeah, I know several folks kind of looked at this, which is pretty cool. One of the highlights, I have to say, is probably Pretzel Jack, who is played by an actual real-life contortionist. There was no CG. I mean, I'm sure there was some CG at some point in the making of the show or maybe in post-processing or something, but it's like an actual real-life contortionist. His name is Trid James, rather, and he was actually in the third season as well as sort of a physical embodiment of schizophrenia, which is also interesting and pretty cool. But here, he is playing this like really terrifying creation called Pretzel Jack, who is something of a protector figure for Jill, but also a maniacal killer, which is pretty cool and pretty interesting.
Interesting, side note, he is a black contortionist playing a creepy white clown.
Yes, that's super important.
Very true, yes.
Yeah, especially given... So the lead character is in fact biracial.
Okay.
And it's, I think, without getting into specific spoilers about stuff, her father is white. And
yes.
So for me, the fact that Pretzel Jack...
And looks a little like him.
Absolutely. Pretzel Jack is absolutely designed to look like a thinner version of the man who plays her father with this kind of, like, splotch of blonde hair, like, very, like, thin hair. Not thinning, but, like there's a lot I'm looking for.
Wispy and...
Wispy, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. So, yeah, I think that's super important here, too. I had such mixed feelings about this, actually.
Okay.
I think overall I ended up liking it. I think one thing I'll say is, like, it is not... I expected the show to continue to be, like, the first two episodes, and instead it ends up going in this much more campy direction that it did not set me up for particularly well, because I think, like, the first episode is genuinely creepy. And I think even the second episode is pretty creepy. And in general, so this whole series, I'm from what I've read, is converts creepypasta into kind of short run series.
It'd be worth kind of
right?
setting that up for people a little bit. So, like, I was so yeah, creepypasta is basically just internet short horror stories. It comes
like 1,000 words, 500 words, short.
Yeah,
little...
yeah, something you can read in you know while you're sipping you know half a cup of coffee. It comes from the term copypasta, which is like the notion of human spam, which is basically like copying and pasting like blocks of text on forums. it's like many things on the internet, which is like not something we have to necessarily consider within this, but is like a broader consideration, is that creepypastas originate from 4chan. Like, we talk about 4chan, and rightly so, as like a reviled, awful place on the internet where all sorts of terrible things happen. But like a lot of the internet culture that we like is just sanitized versions of things that come from 4chan. Like, 4chan has defined and created all sorts of like predominant internet culture, including the original idea of the creepypasta. It's not like 100% sure where it comes from. There's like a timepiece that like roughly has some evidence that it comes from 2006. And like the idea, like the terminology of creepypasta, like short form horror fiction is not new, but the idea of like actually calling it creepypasta seems to be roughly 2006. Like, Slender Man is creepypasta, like, and that's like the more like broader like pop culture instance of creepypasta, like both making it its way into like small form adaptation. There's Marble Hornets, which is this long form in that there's dozens and dozens of episodes. Short form in that the episodes are like a couple of minutes long, but they're like, it's found footage. It's sort of a Slender Man story that exists on YouTube in like 480p because it's from years and years and years ago. And then there was also like a really bad Slender Man movie. And then also Slender Man made its way full circle into real life. It was the subject of a recent HBO documentary because two 12-year-old girls killed one of their friends over a belief that they were appeasing Slender Man. So like, interesting, like in this movie, this one is based on a short story called, I take issue. This show calls it based on a short story. It is based on a creepypasta. It is kind of weird in the opening credits, like, based on a short story called blah, blah, blah. When it's based on a creepypasta called I Found a Hidden Door in My Cellar and I Think I've Made a Big Mistake. And it comes from a Reddit post.
It's very good.
By someone named Voids with the zero instead of an O. Their name is Charlotte, you know, Bywater. Like, you know, there is a person behind that. But, like, I do wish the show, like, this show is internet culture, but, like, doesn't want to pretend it is, because it's probably, that would seem, like, embarrassing to some degree, I guess. But, yeah, so, anyway, I just wanted to set up a little bit of, like, the history of creepypasta there, because it informs a lot of the show from front to back.
I've always felt about creepypasta that it is, like, a contemporary campfire story,
yep.
That creepypasta are often, like, so there I was, like, it was a dark and rainy night, except that you're on the internet, and so you say, like, well, I just got home from the gym, and, you know, the Monday Night Football was on TV, and I went into the kitchen to get a beer, and I noticed my basement door was open, and da-da-da-da-da, and it's, like, that sort of style. And
very
I think
casual
first,
style.
Very casual, and then something unknowably terrible happens, and often it's the case, and this is not the case with this show, but in Creepypasta, the scary thing happens, and then it's inexplicable, or it's tied in, like, the SCP stuff to some larger meta context, yeah. But often it's very unsatisfying in the lore sense, and that's okay, because that's not what it's meant to be. It's just supposed to be, like, the actual story, the original creepypasta here is, like, it ends with, like, and there are ancient runes drawn in this secret basement, and who knows what we let out in the evil that, or out into the world that night, what Pandora's box we opened. And, like, yeah, okay, I've heard this sort of story before. Whereas here, there is a very specific mythology of types of creatures that come from a certain specific place, from a certain specific sort of trauma and specific sorts of interaction, and deeper than that, like, very specific, oh, here is how this works, here is who can do this. And I still don't know how that sits with me specifically.
So this show, I will say, I'm like a super fan of this show. I will absolutely cop to that. And I will say there is an unevenness inherent sort of to the show. Even I think in its absolute best moments, there is a campiness to it. There is a sort of visual language component to it. That is very, very, very heightened.
Especially by
very,
the end.
Very, oh my God, especially by the end. Very, 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 like, I think what this is evoking, especially by the end, through, like, weird framing, there's a lot of shots that are, like, way pulled out, very, very uncomfortable. Even though this is happening, most of what's happening here are in interiors, they're in houses, or they're in sort of a very suburban sort of atmosphere, or
houses
by
the
very, very end.
Thing.
Exactly. Houses are the most important thing. Doors are an important motif here. But by the very, very end, it is happening in sort of a half-finished plot of land that is, like, being developed as a new neighborhood. So it is using incredibly obvious, kind of hit-you-over-the-face visual metaphors. Things like girders and things that are half-built are kind of, you know, in every other shot, I think, by the very end. It's using hundreds of doors, whereas you see, like, single doors, you know, kind of at the beginning of the series. This is not a subtle show. Like, I don't think there's any subtlety in this show ever. And it sometimes goes way over the top. I think the third season probably went the furthest over the top out of anything. Again, we have Rutger Hauer playing a weird farmer who eats people, and it's amazing. he was great in it, of course. But there is a sort of... I think, like, the show has been building towards certain things. Sort of even though they are self-contained seasons. Stories. Okay. Yeah, I think it's been building its visual language and building its visual language. Season 2 had a lot of very stylized cinematography and extremely, like, processed shots, like, post-processed. Mm. Like, there's filters on everything. There's sort of an entire suburban world in that second season where everything has, like, a blue filter over it, right? There's a lot of filters and stuff going on here as well. There is a lot of, like... avant-garde light, I would call it, kind of cinematography and sound design. And by the way, the sound designer and the composer for this season was actually the same person who did the soundtrack for Edith Finch.
Oh, interesting.
I have that, and I will put it in the show notes who that person is. But it, really a little out there, and everything that they're doing is a little out there. And I actually really love that. I kind of love that they have divorced almost entirely from really sort of traditional horror cinematography. A lot of horror cinematography focuses a lot on close-up shots to sort of create tension. Like, you know, in the haunted house when it's super close up on the person walking around, you know something horrible is going to happen to them. In this show, you're pulled out so far. You're looking basically at like a super super wide shot where Pretzel Jack is running around. You can kind of see him running around the bush. And the person he's going to attack is just sort of standing there, you know, for a few seconds. Like, it is so completely out of line with what you usually see in terms of framing and editing in these kinds of stories. And I really like that. I do think it's effective here, even though it does have a very sort of specific and weird vibe at times. And there are times where I do think it's a little bit dissonant. Like, this is a show very much about personal relationships, personal trauma, and sort of fear in relationships. So Jill is really, really afraid that her husband is cheating on her or has cheated on her. That is like a central theme that kind of goes through this entire show. And you do learn that Pretzel Jack has a special connection with her. Again, I'm going to keep things fairly vague and just kind of talk about the themes here. But you do learn that he is something of a protector figure for her. And that puts the husband in danger. And it is such a good metaphor for, like, yeah, in relationships, you carry your fucking trauma with you, and you're going to push people away, and you're going to do all of these kinds of things, and it's going to feel this tense, and it's going to feel this dangerous. But of course, because it's horror, it's actually making that metaphor real, and it's doing that with this, like, really weird visual language that I think is, like, effectively off-putting in a lot of ways.
I mean, like, I think part of what you're getting at, Austin, is, like, okay.
Yeah.
I like Channel Zero. I like this. I haven't watched the other seasons of Channel Zero. I've watched the first... There's 6 episodes. I've watched 5 of this season. And I like it a lot. There is horror for horror fans. And then there is horror that is meant for a broader audience. Like, and Channel Zero is horror for horror fans. In which
Yeah.
It is playing with themes. And there are characters. And there are metaphors. Do those exist because it has something really deep to say? I don't think so. Do they exist because, like, it gives some depth and, like, allows it to go over the course of, like, 6 episodes? I think so. Like, it's more like that stuff is used as architecture to prop up the things that it's most effective and good at, which is, like, it is, like, Pretzel Jack is one of the more effective villains I have seen in a piece of horror in 10 years. Like, I'm here for that. The other stuff is fine. It's there. It's deeper than, like, your average horror film, but you know, like, it's...
I felt by the end of it, I think I understand what it was, like, going for. I want to be clear. I didn't dislike watching this. I watched all 6 episodes, right? I didn't bail. I didn't say, oh, I watched half of it and that's enough. Right. Partially because it changed a number of times in terms of what it was doing. Again, the first 2 episodes just feel like horror to me, and then it gets increasingly campy and goofy until some final confrontations that are, like, they're not straight out of a video game, but there is gaming happening in one of those sequences, right? There is definitely an esports scene at the end of this movie, or the end of this series, in a sense. There is, like, there's an FGC showdown between people playing something against each other, in a sense. But the thing that I actually kept me most interested and kept me most – the thing that I was actually so unsure about were those things that you're talking about, both Danielle and Patrick, in terms of what is it saying about relationships and about trauma and about – violence against women and about emotion. There are moments in this where I could tell it was trying to say something about gaslighting, right? Mm-hmm. Because there are lots of men who do not believe Jillian about Pretzel Jack in the beginning of the show. But there are also moments when she is jumping to conclusions about people in her life, and the result of that is that she gets emotional, and the result of that is that people get hurt, and innocent people get hurt and die. And some of the framing on that stuff felt very conservative to me. And there was a reading – there's a way in which I can imagine someone watching this and be like, yeah, women need to control their emotions. And that read is in this story. And the conclusion of it, without talking about specifics, ends up feeling to me like a sort of a reestablishment of the status quo of like, here is what – this is what a healthy family looks like. Certainly unhealthy family is here, and I'm in agreement with the show about what unhealthy family looks like. Unhealthy – like it's – their depiction of an unhealthy family is 100% true, but there is something about it that's like the reestablishment of the norm as good. That is not – I'm not saying this is true for most things in fiction, that you reestablish what the status quo is as being a good thing. But it's hard for me to square that with my real understanding that the status quo in real life does produce trauma, often against women. And it's hard to talk about this stuff without talking about spoilers.
Right.
It really is hard, and I don't want to get into it. But what I will say is that insofar as Pretzel Jack is the result of trauma and the result of Jillian working through trauma, which is a thing that's brought up very early on. I don't feel too bad talking about that. The resolution around it just didn't satisfy me that much, because it reestablishes a norm that in real life still leads to that trauma. And it ends with an open door, obviously. Not literally an open door.
Well, kind of.
Kind of. But kinda. Not literally an open – like, you know what I'm saying, right?
Yeah.
It ends with that. And again, I had a good time with it, but I felt like some of the stuff that I'd hoped would be clearer especially because these are black characters, and especially because I think black masculinity and black femininity are often – tools wielded by white creative teams in ways to create things like horror and pettiness and pity in ways that are very charged. And likewise with the contortionist with Pretzel Jack, the bodies that don't act normally is a very charged thing. So I wanted a little more clarity on here. But I still think it was like a fairly entertaining show, right? I would have ejected if I thought otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly can't argue with any of the reading, especially on people of color. But I did read it so much more as this is this is how violent it is to have emotions and to be a human that has creative power.
Yeah.
Right. That's how I read it personally. And so it did work for me. Jill did read for me as a character, as a woman of color, who the cops don't fucking believe her, because of course they don't. There's a couple of detectives who kind of come in and they're around for a lot of this, right?
Sure.
Like, yeah, they sure have a scene that is interesting and also framed amazingly. Like, one day I would love to have like a 10-minute, like, here's how this is so effective. This shot is amazing. But anyway, absent that and speaking in generalities, I really did find it effective as a sort of treatment of it is fraught. It is always fraught when you're talking about women and their emotions, and especially within like a heterosexual context, right? I feel like, okay, if she were a lesbian and she was with another woman or something, that would be absent in this, right? Mm. It would be a little more like, oh, okay, instead of just she's the woman and therefore her emotions are an issue, this is like a hetero fucking thing. So that's how it looks. But I did take that from it of being like, okay, this is – Your emotions are fucking violent. Your trauma is fucking violent. You will hurt another person.
Yeah.
There's no way around that. You're a human being. Being in a relationship, being close to someone is violent in some ways. It is a violation of all these things that you have kind of inside you. And they're going to come out in some way. And again, it's horror. So the metaphors become real. They become very real. They become blood splattered and they become exploitative and so on and so forth. But yeah, it is very – it's very hard to read this without reading extra into, obviously, the racial component. And, like, that sucks because that's that is part of, like, the genre sucking at having a lot of diverse characters.
I mean, I'm happy to have that stuff in there. Like, I think given that she's a biracial character and given Pretzel Jack as this, like, pasty white clown figure with this, you know,
this fucked up version of her dad kind of thing. 100%. Yeah.
Like, there's, I'm happy for people to be working in that space. Yeah. I just don't always, it doesn't always stick the landing for me.
Yeah.
Natalie and Rob both have been sitting on something for a long time. I'm sorry.
No, Natalie, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm just curious to, like, is this show, like, contending or being, like, careful with sort of, like, tropes of, like, crime of passion, is, like, something that I was thinking about. Like, are we, you know, like, playing into, like, this perception of women of color, like, acting violently on emotions, like, in a very literal sense, which was, like, kind of a concern with mine. And I wasn't sure that, I think the proxy of having, like, a third party, like, having Pretzel Jack there kind of, like, as this other by which it is acted kind of mitigates that. So I like, am working through it in my head right now, but I do feel like there is.
So, like, I mean, for me, like, a note I made here was watching the first episode, I was like, this is like if Poltergeist was good.
Yeah!
Uh-huh, Patrick, how's it going?
Sorry, let me just mute Patrick real quick. okay, God. So I think one of the things the show deploys pretty powerfully is that, like, there's a tendency for people to love the idea of new beginnings, new phases of your life starting. And I think one of the things the show does really well is, first of all, like, the couple is given a home, which immediately, like, man, I would, I don't care if a creepy door shows up in my basement. I'll stay. Like, you give me a free house, I'm there. But also there's this element of, so if you look at the horror in Poltergeist, it's a new subdivision. It's a new thing that's planted in the middle of nowhere. It's these, like, these sins of the country, the land, the society that are being visited on the family that is fundamentally blameless. Their mistake is buying the wrong house. Here is this idea of we're newlyweds, we've been gifted a home, and this is a chance to start fresh. And these are characters that are both deeply in denial about how much they are carrying with them into this relationship and carrying with them into this new stage of their lives. And I think one of the things I found really powerful here was that, sorry, did I lose somebody?
Something just changed.
I heard the tone, but
sorry, my computer died.
Oh, okay.
And now I'm offline and I can't control the brightness on my screen anymore.
Okay.
So I can't hear. I haven't been able to hear anything in like 3 minutes.
I was wondering why you're looking around. Okay.
I can't hear anything now, for instance.
Okay.
Sorry.
We'll hold for a second.
You have a computer?
Yeah, I am.
Oh, so you should just be.
My computer died?
In there.
Oh. I gotcha. That'll work. I've not been this whole time.
It's this one, right, that you can use? Is it this one?
No, it's
different.
It's,
yeah.
Oh, there's just a blank one. Okay.
Cool. Thank you.
Okay.
Can you say something?
Something.
Is the static still there, Kato? Huh? Is the static still there?
Yeah, that's something from the road. I don't know what happened.
I definitely hear like a mild.
Is it just loose? Is like the power cord loose, or is?
It might be the voltage here. Can you take off your headphones?
Yeah. Oh, it went away.
Okay.
Yeah, I heard awesome. Like a burp, and then it went away. Okay, cool. All
right.
All right. So something I did find powerful here is this idea that the horror that is being unleashed is because people are not honest with themselves about the impossibility of there ever being a clean start. The start that, you know, Tom is telling Jill, you know, I'm not your father, and which, by the way, is like a thermonuclear thing to roll out and deploy in a couple spat, especially when you are definitely keeping a secret, Tom. Like, what the fuck?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
But the way that they both have made this really false deal that we are kind of this... we have this new unit, this new familial unit, unencumbered by the past, and the patterns of the past are not going to recur. And that is kind of, at least in the early episodes, the original sin that sets a lot of things in motion, right? That it's as they begin to deny that there's all these things sort of haunting the relationship, that they begin escalating the horrors that they're about to unleash. And that did work for me. Now, I didn't get to the end of the series. I missed the camp turn. So what I saw was a very like...
Did you watch the first three episodes?
I watched the first two.
Okay, yeah. Basically, like, yeah, there's like a good arc, and then it should have stopped, and then there's just more episodes.
I would like a
shittier villain, and then a shitty new side, a shitty new main character, and yeah. I think it's working on a mess.
A lot of levels, but go ahead, Rob.
Yeah. So yeah, for me, when the series in the opening episode of the series, I see a very good, again, the literalization of the horror of things we carry with us into relationships, breakdowns in communication, the way survival and coping strategies become, almost offensive weapons in other contexts. So I liked all of that. I'm a little disappointed to hear that it sort of maybe leaves that behind a little bit.
I think it still works with those concepts 100%, but it isn't like the first two episodes have a lot of creeping horror, right? They have a lot of, there's an unopened door in a basement. There's a locked door in a basement is such a strong premise because who knows what's in there, right? It's like, it's like y'all are all bigger horror fans than me. You don't need me to talk about the fear of the unknown, et cetera, et cetera. But like, even just on a pure, like, living my own fucking life level, I don't want there to be a door in my house that I don't know what's behind it. I've shot it
with a gun and it won't open.
That's scary to me. Things of that nature.
Also, why
doors that don't open.
No one talks in this show about the handprint that's on the door. Everyone just pretends that's not a weird thing. Like, no one at any point comments about the hand on the door.
It's great. That stuff I love. I love, love, love. And I think
is it visible to everybody? That's the thing that I started to wonder. Does everyone see the handprint?
I guess it's possibly only visible to Jillian.
Because we get that interstitial shot that's from her. It's not her image of the door. It's from her memories of something.
Right.
So like we see the handprint on the door, and then a child's like painted wall next to it. So I'm kind of wondering, like, is this one of the other reasons this is so unsettling for her? It's like she recognizes that fucking door. To everyone else, it's a blue door. And she sees a handprint.
Right. Yeah.
It's a nice... sorry, you were going to say something. I was going to say, it's actually a really nice counterpoint to the red door in The Haunting of Hill House, which, again, I won't spoil, but what goes on behind that door, and when you find out kind of what goes on behind that door, there's a lot of sort of thematic resonance that kind of sticks with you in that case. That's another door you can't open, no matter what you do. No matter how many things you do to that door, it's not going to open of your volition. It only opens of its own volition, whether you made it, whether you created it or not.
Right. And then there's, yeah. And so that stuff was so strong. And I think the point I was trying to get to before was, I still think the stuff that you're interested in, Rob, around the ways in which we wish we could start from a clean slate and the ways in which we're always already complicated and all relationships are built on a navigation of that complication. I think Danielle's right in that stuff continues to be prevalent in the back half. I personally am also on Patrick's side that I wish that this was a 3-hour show or like a 2-hour show or movie.
I just think with the turn it takes in the second half is more interested in world building of this, of what they've set up.
What happens, what?
Then in exploring, like, the most fundamentally
interesting story
at the core of this is, like, this relationship and the manifestation of secrets.
That's right? Also, I just wish that I personally would have gone into the back half with, like, a couple of beers and while playing a video game if I had been prepped for that, and would have probably enjoyed it as really good, like, campy, like, fun horror that, like, it moves more in the slasher direction in some ways than it
with the worst
with.
Slasher villain.
Like, that other guy's not as good. It's Pretzel Jack.
Tall Boy sucks, I'll tell you that much.
I think it makes good on a lot of that stuff because of what it's doing with reproduction. There is a really creepy scene. Again, I can't spoil it. But
we can have a 10-minute spoiler section. Like, we're adults.
No, it's okay. I think I might just be the one who's, you know, the Channel Zero fan here, and I'm okay with that. I'm all right with that. This is my bad.
I made it. No, I mean, I want to make it clear. Like, the first couple, like, that arc of the first three episodes, like, where they leave that, I was like, it was beautiful. I thought it was interesting. Like, it's not high art, but like I really, really liked those first couple episodes.
You would have left it at the pool.
I would have left it at the pool. Okay. I think I would have left it at the pool, and I would have left it with the hospital scene. Like,
okay.
Once you have that, like, it leaves enough loose ends that are interesting. Like, I didn't need for the rest to be resolved. And like, what happens here is it's one season, but there's a sequel. Like,
in
the first
season.
Three episodes are the first movie.
It's actually the first four, because that pool scene is the end of episode four. I'm pretty sure. Because I watched 1, 2, 3, I stopped.
Yeah.
And then I watched 4, 5, 6, like, a night or two ago.
Okay, yeah. Well, wherever ends. Like, yeah. the pool slash hospital scene, like, where that ends up is, like, the first movie. And then it's like, what does every horror sequel do? It's like, well, shit, we got to explain what happened, right? And so 5 and 6 are like, here's the backstory. And it's like, it's more complicated than you imagined. When really, leaving it open-ended, leaving you to, like, wonder, leaving things complicated, I haven't seen the last episode, but, like, episode 5.
Oh, you should watch the last episode.
Yeah.
I'm going to. We're going to watch it tonight. But it is the shitty sequel. It's, you know.
See, this is, like, a hallmark.
There's stuff I think
this.
You will appreciate. There's stuff that I think Patrick will love in the final episode.
Yeah.
But.
Well, this is, like, a hallmark of that entire, like, one of the things I have noticed with, like, Reddit no sleep threads and shit is this, there's this tendency for, like, once a post gets traction, the creator to come back and be like, well, there's more.
Yeah,
and it's like, oh shit,
way.
Like, okay, like, people are, like, getting a lot of upvotes. Like, okay, so I need a story now. I had a central image or conceit. Now I need a narrative, I guess. Sure, I'll give that. Like, keep those votes coming. And I think, like, maybe the series struggles against this a little bit too, is like a lot of the source material that this is pulling from tends to exist as, like, unsettling premises, things to, like, freak you out late at night when you're, like, just browsing the internet and you come across, like, creepy fake urban legend. And that's cool, but that is hard to build a coherent narrative around. And you're tackling a big challenge to make a season of television around that, particularly when you're engaging all these themes.
I may have just been very, very, very sort of devoted to that core relationship. And the places that core relationship goes, especially by the end, were, I suppose, enough for me to really kind of stick with it. And what it says about parenthood and family is there's a very, very, very difficult scene to watch. It is extremely intense, and it has to do with childbirth, and it has to do with reproduction. It has to do with, like, your worst fears as a parent and that kind of thing that I think make good on a lot of the sort of thematic weight that they're throwing at it in that sort of second half. Tall Boy does suck, though. I'm not going to stand for Tall Boy.
I just think, like, I think you're right, Daniel. I think that relationship.
Good.
I think that relationship does go to some interesting places. The problem is just, like, the priority of, like, what's happening, like, changes in as it goes to the end game in terms of, like, what the show finds important and what it's prioritizing in terms of what it wants, like, the screen time and the story. And it's like their relationship takes a back seat, like, to the other stuff that's going on. Like, the world building becomes story A, and then the relationship becomes story B or C. It's like, so there are standout scenes.
That might be episode,
like,
5.
That's 5.
There's a possibility that there's, like, kind of a weakness there, but I do think it brings it back.
It definitely, 6 is still definitely about their core relationship in a way. And again, like, I'm not personally super satisfied with that ending for reasons I don't want to get into because spoilers, but I will say the thing that I just hit on that makes the first half work better for me is that the kind of triangle of Tom, Jillian, and Pretzel Jack, with Pretzel Jack being the externalization of trauma, but also of fear and emotional like anger, works for me in a way because it makes the Jillian Tom relationship the kind of producer of Pretzel Jack, and then that gets mixed up with some other shit that is really complicated because it ends up being about heritage, it ends up being about prior relationships, it ends up also then being about you know, this is what happens when you have characters of mixed race, is that it ends up being about questions of parental lineage and questions of how that lineage was framed and stuff. Like, there's stuff I want to get into that I cannot get into. And specifically, it introduces a secondary antagonist who is not Pretzel Jack, unlike Pretzel Jack, whose motivations I think are pretty clear from the fucking get-go, outside of some small elements they're major elements that tie into all the shit I was just saying, but, like, they're not, his, like, who he is as a person, I think, is, like, clear on the fucking screen out the gate for me. I was like, oh, this motherfucker here.
Yep.
Yeah.
I see this guy right here. And by the time you get all that extra information, it ends up on just a craft level messing up that very nice triangle by turning it into like a pentagon or like an octagon of relationships.
A pentagram indeed.
It's a pentagram of relationships. 666. That's why click. Very witchy. But specifically ends up going into some spaces around. It's not about whiteness and blackness, but it is absolutely about. There's another. I'm not going to talk about it. I'm going to let it go. People should go watch it. I think it's very interesting who naturally was allowed to come to terms with trauma and experience, and who wasn't. I think there's something interesting in a positive sense happening there. There is something sharp about the recognition of who gets to control power and who doesn't. But I also am frustrated by it because plenty of black women confront trauma and come out the other end having dealt with it. And having been through their natural lives without any additional aid, having learned from trauma, having dealt with their emotions, and having been able to become, you know, grown, full, well-rounded adults. And it's frustrating to see a show in which the options that are on the table are the options that are on the table, and the way that stuff is framed. It's fine. It's not I'm not like mad at this show, but it felt like it was playing with some big ideas, and then it added more big ideas on top of it, and then it was both too long, and that six episodes is too long for that core first little premise, but maybe not long enough to actually work out some of the more complicated stuff that ends up being about race and heritage and trauma and the intermingling therein. That's what I will say.
Yeah, I would also add, watch season two. If you found anything at all interesting about this season or this approach to an anthology series, season two.
I'm very curious
also,
about it, for sure.
I also really thought it was great.
So. Also, the music changes in this, and that's super interesting. We don't have the time to get into that also. But by the end of the series, it is doing like a full synthwave retro thing, which I think leads into the feeling of it being campier than the opening stuff where it's just like not as all in on that stuff.
Yeah. That's fair.
We will leave it there, and we'll come back in a minute here with the Ballad of Black Tom.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
All right, and we're back with The Ballad of Black Tom by Victor Laval. which was something that, Austin, you put in front of us when we were getting ready for our Lovecraft-focused discussion show. And you said this was, because I think we put the question out, like, is there anything out there that, like, redeems this, right? Like, is there anything there that, like, plays with this material in, that can explain some of the love that people have for this universe, for this genre? And this was one you sort of suggested as being worth putting on our radar for that discussion. And
I, like, dumped a bunch of links on you, unfortunately, right before, like, the night or two before y'all recorded the Lovecraft episode.
So go read this novella.
Listen, well, okay, so some things were smaller. I did put, like, a couple of short stories in front of you. But then also, I was like, you had asked Rob, like, oh, is there anything that redeems it or that confronts the racist history of Lovecraft? And the answer is, like, yeah, there's probably a lot, actually, right? Like, this is an active field. Lovecraft studies is a field with lots of people in it, and many of them are smart enough to contend with the not just his racist past or his personal racism, but the way that racism runs through his work.
It was like 10 years ago or something when, like, the award that was given out that had his face was changed.
Yeah.
As a result of, like, these conversations, and I'm like, it's because one of the artists that won that year, one of the writers that won that year, like, made, like, a really
this was the big deal about World Fantasy Award. And so a number of authors, like, lobbied against it and were like, "Yo, can you not actually do this?"
When I was reading about it, like, one of the first instincts was, "Well, just change it to, like, Cthulhu or something, like, instead, like, make it about the world he represents." And then it was from there, it was like, well,
oh, what's Cthulhu like a stand in for, actually?
Right,
yeah,
right.
So, I mean, I'll set up the book very briefly. It's written by Victor Laval, who is a black writer who grew up in Queens. I think that it is explicitly a retelling, or it's not just a retelling in the sense of same events happen, it's a retelling in that it's an alternate version of the horror at Red Hook, which is one of Lovecraft's most outwardly racist works, in that it is filled from top to bottom with descriptions of New York and New Yorkers as squalid and diverse in the most insulting tone. He sees the mixing of peoples, both in the sexual sense, but literally just in the geographical sense, as being a great sin and the road to the worst sort of unimaginable foreign dark exotic hells. Lovecraft will spend in the horror of Red Hook, you know, he says things like, the poison cauldron where all the varied dregs of unwholesome ages mix their venom and perpetuate their obscene terrors. And what he means is, like, the blacks, Jews, Syrians, and Italians. That's what the varied dregs of unwholesome ages means. In another story, he writes that New York filled him, his kind of stand-in protagonist, with only a sense of horror and depression which threatened to master, paralyze, and annihilate him, and that the throngs of people that seethed through the flume-like streets were squat, swarthy strangers with hardened faces and narrow eyes, shrewd strangers without dreams and without kinship to the scenes about them, who could never mean aught to a blue-eyed man of the old folk with the love of fair green lanes and white New England village steeples in his hearts. Lovecraft fucking hates New York, and he hates everyone who is not, like, a WASP, basically. He loves New England. He loves England. He loves the old world. And in The Ballad of Black Tom, by shifting away from characters who see the world that way and instead see a sort of pulse of life and connectivity and what Laval describes as the terrific buzzing of Harlem, he rewrites the story in a way that at once maintains the horror of Lovecraft, a horror that originates at things not like us, that originates at the unknown, but situates it in a specific historical pain and oppression. I still think this is like it's 150 pages. There are still things here that make me go like, okay. But I think that many of the ways in which the characters of the original story are recast in new ways, and then the addition of Black Tom himself, substantially shifts the story into something that maintains a lot of that horror, but doesn't assume, make the same assumptions about why it's horrible. Does that make sense?
Yes.
I guess, like, for my big picture, the thing that I – there's a lot that's horrible about Lovecraft's horror, but the thing that – the way I've always framed it, or the way I've always spoken about one of the things that, that Lovecraft finds horrible or finds scary, is that Lovecraft writes in the modern era. He writes in the early 20th century, post-Enlightenment, post-industrialization. One, as we talked about last week, he is one of these people who wishes for an older, simpler time that never really existed. But two, one of the things that I think is actually still good about cosmic horror, or one of the things that I think other people have drawn on and done their own work with, is it comes from a moment in time at which the sciences are discovering new things, and we have a new belief in science and a new belief in capital R rationality. And Lovecraftian horror begins at, what if science isn't enough to explain everything? What if, despite all of our greatest minds, geometry is just broken? What if, in fact, all of this is incorrect?
We understand so little that it means absolutely nothing.
That it means nothing. And that the world is, and as this book hits on again and again, indifferent to us. And the thing that makes Black Tom so effective for me is that it says, like, one, there are those of us who already live in a life that is indifferent to us. Two, many of us live in a life that is cruel and not indifferent, and we cannot even begin to imagine why indifference would be scary compared to cruelty, nor should we. And the thing that I like about Black Tom, the Ballad of Black Tom as a book, is that it retains the ways in which you can describe the otherworldly while situating it in the characterization about pain, and like the reason that someone would go in that direction is about pain and about suffering and not just crazed otherness, you know?
Yeah, I was – or go ahead.
Or like pursuit of knowledge.
Right.
Like I think like when you were just talking about like some of the things that – like the one – I don't know. I had such a hard time contending with Lovecraft when we did the – Waypoint Radio episode on him, because for me it is there are times in which I like choose to not separate art from the artist. Like I to all of my fucking Twitter mentions, yeah, I've read Death to the Artist, like I know what the fuck that is.
That's
like,
not what Barton meant either.
Anyway. Yeah, and
so
it is also
to you with
yeah.
That, they should reread that.
Yeah. So
or read it in the first place. Let's be fucking real here.
Yeah. So for me, I think the one thing that, like, on further reflection and thinking about Lovecraftian horror and cosmic horror even more is something that, you know, I saw in Bloodborne and do see in other people writing in the Lovecraftian horror scene is like this critique of that pursuit of knowledge, and a critique of sort of the way that institutions create or delineate like accepted knowledge, that we like intelligence or a knowledge or a study that is like deemed worthy or
canonized in some way, basically.
Yeah, basically. And how those pursuits, how the pursuit of knowledge is fundamentally like what I think about the knowledge that is like uncovered and that is like still misunderstood or still could not be understood. To me, it's like almost a question of like the ethics of that pursuit. Like
to
I think
begin with.
Yeah, I think like the best form of contending with this is like questioning those like ethical, like the absence of ethics in that motivation.
Sure. Knowledge for knowledge's sake, or
yeah. You know,
whatever we're calling knowledge even from the jump, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So the one thing is, what are we calling knowledge? Like, what do we deem as accepted knowledge? What do, like, institutions deem accepted knowledge? And the second thing is the latter.
Yeah, and I think this book ends up shifting on some of that stuff, right? So the horror at Red Hook has two characters from this in it already. It has the detective Malone, who is in horror at Red Hook, this outwardly bigoted, racist, like virulent, constantly seeing the world, is terrified of the world around him. And it has Suidim, the Dutch. It's always the Dutch with Lovecraft. He does not like the Dutch either. Kind of collector of oddities and paranormal. In the original story, this wild man, right? His hair is overgrown and his fingernails are dirty. And here he is this kind of suave, like, mover of the upper echelons of moneyed New York. And Malone,
it seems to kind of keep that subplot, like a nod to that subplot in, I don't want to get into it, but there's a nod to that exact, like, depiction of him in a subplot involving him and his family that
totally,
I haven't read the original, but
that's in there.
But you saying that is like a very cute kind of way to head nod at the original.
100%. Well, and so instead, and Malone in this is this kind of passive bigot who absolutely judges the lesser peoples of New York, but he's, he's the guy from around the neighborhood. He's, they all talk to him. They all say hi to him.
There's a line where, like, the author describes him as, like, someone that just, like, looks around and he's just disappointed about, like, where the world has gone, which is, like, such a, like, he thinks very highly of himself that, like, I'm not the racist, like, I'm not the shitty person, like, society's just, it's just gone wrong, man.
And Suidem is recast as this person who was just wildly devoted to the dark gods, to someone who is, my people have done so wrong by everyone here. What if we just started over? What if we just remade the world?
But me. Leading.
I'll be there.
This deep greed of, like, I can be the one who can get the most from the sleeping king.
Yeah.
I'm curious what the general takeaway was here as just, like, this is a work of horror. This is a book of, like, attempting to do what Lovecraft does and what other cosmic horror writers do, but also attempting to be this very new black New York. Like, again, there is almost a campfire story element of this, of like, the Ballad of Black Tom. You know about Black Tom, right? That style.
I was very taken by that, by the love of New York, by the sort of evocative descriptions of New York, what it looks like and smells like and feels like, and in that being a vibrant place and a good place and a positive place, you know, sort of the opposite framing of a busy place. You know, you could kind of go, oh, a busy place, oh, you know, and go that sort of racist way, that kind of disgusting, bigoted way that Lovecraft did, or you can actually embrace it because this is where you're from, this is what you're made of, this is a beautiful and wonderful thing and a diverse thing. So that's one of the things I took away from it the most.
Yeah, there are some, like, I think, like, actually moving passages in the book about the feel of being in New York, often set immediately next to images of violence. This is a book in which a black man is killed unfairly by police. Is a book in which, and images in which there are just great acts of injustice performed against people of color and immigrants, and ways in which the word immigrant is wielded as a weapon. And also a book in which, you know, there are dark gods. There is, you know, there are moments of spell casting, of outright spell casting happening. Rob.
Yeah, I mean, I really loved this book. I think there are such great moments and parallels set up. So one of the things that runs through this book is just transiting from your world, from your neighborhood, to a different world is like a journey in itself. That there are no simple trips that Tom takes, right? That depending on where his stop is on the subway, his experience changes. What happens at the end of that line changes a great deal. And there's this great parallel that's set up at one point. So he is called in to play music, which is weird because he's a shitty musician, but he's called in to play music at the Suidam's party, and he's being paid a lot of money to do it. And so he's walking through this, very not gentrified, but it is the neighborhood where the gentry live of, you know, of a white neighborhood. And he's being stalked by these, you know, three white punks, basically, who are just, like, looking to start shit. And they keep, like, they keep trying to get a rise out of him, and they keep watching him, and they start doing this thing. As he's walking, they're walking so closely to him that they start, like, trying to, you know, you're walking behind somebody, you're trying to catch the back lip of their shoe with the front of yours, you're sort of kicking their bag. They start doing that, and he knows, like, he can't turn around. He can't, like, engage. But the cool thing is that's immediately set when he gets to this destination. He enters this creepy old mansion that immediately spatially doesn't make any sense. Like, it feels like he's not in the building that whose facade he was just standing in front of. But as he's walking down this hallway, he starts to get the same feeling that there is something behind him, and it's starting to brush his bag a little bit. It's starting to, you know, try to kick it out of his hand a little bit. And I think what was cool there is this notion of a lot of the cosmic horror of Lovecraft is just shit that's visited on marginalized people just right and left, right?
Constantly.
That,
yeah.
Oh, there are hostile forces who don't care about you, but they observe you constantly. They fuck
and who
you
cannot look at.
Yes.
If you look at them directly, they will kill you, which is literally the thing that happens with Lovecraftian beasts all the time. Don't look directly at Cthulhu. You will be undone. And for us, it's like, don't look at the three teenagers behind you kicking your bag, because they will end you and there will be a mob if you do anything against them. That is like such a keen observation that I didn't make until just now.
But the other really...
Until you made it, to be clear. Yeah. It's not my observation. It was your observation.
But the other thing I really dig here, too, is that there's kind of a... There isn't one, like, black perspective in the story. Tom has his own bigotries, right? Like, he is African-American, but he's living in a neighborhood that a ton of West Indian people are starting to move in. And he has this conception of them that is also deeply bigoted. He's like, you don't want to go to the Victoria Society. Shit's crazy down there.
Ooh.
And he goes there with a friend one night, and it turns out to be a fucking, like, community center with cheap food, basically. And everyone just, like, it's just a cool time. And that sort of presages what's going to be sort of the tragedy of the ending. But it's this cool sort of acknowledgement that, like, Tom also has these prejudices. He also is skeptical of people he views as his other, right? The people are
right.
People that are like but different than he is. And that is a thing that he doesn't get over, or he doesn't get over in time to sort of change the course of events. And I think that proves to be a really smart move, and also kind of a beautifully tragic one. I think the ending of this is so good. But also, I just fucking love this as a revenge story. I just fucking, just right into my veins. It's delicious.
The degree of revenge is so, it is not outsized, the cost paid him, right? It is, in fact, this sort of, again, we recorded this episode and last week's episode the same day. Like, we took like a 10-minute break between them, 15-minute break between them. We said 10-minute and we took a 30-minute break between them. As we do. And in that one, we talked a lot about the imagined histories and the imagined pasts of colonial empires. So colonial empires that want to pretend, I would get it connects actually back with what we were just talking about with Channel Zero, the idea that there is ever a clean slate. Right? Yeah. Like, oh, well, there's the England of today. We don't have to worry about how England got here. We don't have to worry about how England got to become the big empire it was at the height of World War I. We don't have to talk about the colonies and about the exploitation of people around the world. We can just talk about the European powers as if they've emerged whole cloth. Here, it's a similar thing in that it is the vengeance wrought upon the world by Black Tom is commensurate with the violence done against oppressed people around the world by Western society. It's just it's going to happen all at once, and And whereas colonial violence happens over the course of centuries and centuries and centuries into the future, you know, it continues to happen. And I think that's fascinating, partially because this book also plays with time in a really interesting way. There was a fucking moment in this book that got me that I didn't think.
Oh, I was so confused. And then when I forgot about it, I was like, oh, I was doing the holy shit moment as it builds.
100%. It's great. It's a great reveal. Which I think speaks to partially. I think it speaks to just like the writing is just good. There's enough good like prose.
It's very descriptive in a way that I was constantly impressed by. In which like the attention to detail on just like there was enough detail about the world around you, people's feelings, emotions, reactions to things that it was weird. This is the first audiobook I've ever listened to. I've never listened
to
it
really
before. Awesome. But because I had 36 hours to do this, and I was like, I have more time where I walk around with my dog and my kid where I can be listening to something as opposed to finding 2.5-3 hours to sit down and read a thing. You get in the head of these characters in a way, and there are some like perspective shifts that happen smartly throughout this that I think are really important to like underscoring like the end game and why it is so neatly effective and tragic in a lot of ways. But yeah, I really, really enjoyed this story, and especially because of the descriptors that you're talking about.
There's an important perspective shift. There's two reasons why I think that's super important. One is just is a craft on the craft writing level. The first half of the book is written from Tom's perspective. The second half is written from another character's perspective. And in doing so, one, it means you're not sure what Tom is up to in the second half, which introduces a degree of doubt. And it also underscores some of the tragic elements of the story, because you can start to backfill what was going through Tom's mind after the middle of the book, and be like, oh, fuck, oh, buddy, you know, okay,
it's smart about like what it doesn't fill in,
right? 100%.
Like that's like they're you know, like we were, you know, kind of the channel zero, like the ways like. Reading this like underscored parts of the things I didn't like about Channel Zero, because like it was so much smarter about the things it does or doesn't fill in, and like the lack of information informs what makes other parts of the story, specifically about what Tom does when we have his perspective shift, like that makes that whole payoff so much more effective because you weren't there for every step of the way.
Right. The other half of this is it shows how to write a white racist character in a way that is engaging with their racism and engaging with the cost of their racism.
Without being overly sympathetic.
Yeah.
You're seeing their perspective, but I mean that in the sense that like you're seeing it through their eyes and through their rationale and through their own explanation. And it's a tap dance that most would get
way wrong.
Wrong, but felt authentic in a way that didn't excuse their actions along the way.
I like that we do have the violent, virulent racism of Howard, who's this private detective who's just the worst fucking person in this book.
That's right, his name is Howard. That's good.
Yeah, totally.
I did the thing. Did the thing. Sorry.
Well, Lovecraft is in this book specifically. In the very end, he's like referenced.
They run him out
specifically.
Of
Brooklyn. Yeah.
But
thank God for that.
But then there's Malone, who like Tom visits like a special punishment on him. Befitting the sort of racism that Malone has exhibited throughout the story. But I think. The other thing that I really love is the writing is good. I think dialogue, especially when the characters are speaking, just tends to be very, very good. Like I would definitely read a screenplay from Laval because there are like, especially in the final confrontations as Tom sort of squares off against a lot of these characters, you get some great passages, right? Like, I really enjoyed when these characters started articulating just the worldview they sort of inhabited by the end.
There are moments where, like, I do my best when I write something to take a bunch of notes, and those notes can range from, like, oh, wow, I really appreciate the way this passage is written because it recalls blah, 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 whatever. There are also times when someone just says something like, this motherfucker. And I'm like, yeah, yeah, you know what, Tom? This motherfucker, Tommy Tester. Goddamn. There are...
Well, because the times when they allow his... Because the book is so good about, like, his performance, right? Like, they both describe it as, like, performance for, like, for you know, in front of white people. Also, you know, the reason he has taken an interest in it is because he is seen as a successful illusionist.
Yeah.
Which is, like, both a performance, like... But then those moments where, like, he drops it and we get that internal monologue, or he drops it and we get it externally, yeah, like, are done so sharply and so well that, yes, like, you feel his both rage and satisfaction when that veil drops a bit.
There's an early bit where he's described. So he's a con artist in a sense. He's a bad jazz musician who goes out into the white neighborhoods where they don't know what good jazz sounds like. And I guess we should say this takes place in the 1930s. So we did not actually say that at any point.
It's 20s.
So I can imagine. 20s, right? Is it the late
20s? Yeah, I
feel like. I think it's 1924.
Okay. Okay. I don't know why I had 30s in my head. Yeah, okay. That makes sense. And so goes out into neighborhoods
He goes from Harlem to
Flushing. And then Harlem to, I guess, yeah.
Three neighborhoods are Flushing, Harlem, and Red Hook.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, kind of plays out there because people out there, it doesn't even need to play, right? A lot of times the goal is just to be a person with a guitar case to then get picked up for a performance somewhere, which is technically what happens with Sudiem, except
also a cover for
Being a messenger,
being like a
smuggler or like a courier.
And the fact that he couldn't do it in his own, he can't do it in Harlem because they'd see through his bullshit. They would just see, like, one, there'd be good artists, and like, two, they know that you're running a hustle. So it's like, you got to go to where the white people's interpretation of what a black blues musician looks like. It's not just a black blues musician. It's what do white people think a black blues musician looks like.
Well, because we get an image of a black blues musician who is his father, which would not fit their stereotype. You know, maybe it would a little bit, but it would not necessarily be his father. There are so many sequences in this book that are so good about putting on the persona you need to move through the world. There's a bit early on where he writes, becoming unremarkable, invisible, compliant, these were useful tricks for a black man in an all-white neighborhood, survival techniques. And there's a moment when his father gives him a little razor blade on a piece of cord, like around a necklace, and explains a similar story, which is like, yeah, I used to like be on trains. I used to jump from train to train to travel. And there's a great bit where he's like, you know, and when Otis, who's his father, was a younger man, he had the thing that younger men had, which is to I forget the exact phrasing, but it's something around like to travel more than you actually need. You know, like to get from point A to point B, he kind of wanted to also visit some other stuff on the way, and to travel where he traveled, like whatever your race was, they did not like itinerant travelers in that way. You would get caught up and beat the fuck up. And so he used to walk around with this razor. And there's this moment of recognition from Tommy that is like, oh, shit, right, my dad was 20 once. My father also has techniques. And in some senses, even, you know, the songs, the handful of songs Tommy knows are all techniques as well. And there's a lot of work done around – again, just like with Channel Zero, what does it mean to be a creator? What does it mean to create something? What does it mean to bring something into the world? And what things are like Channel Zero, the question of revenge and the question of acceptable violence comes up a lot here towards the end of the book, where we end up moving into spaces that are meant to evoke horror for us, but also feel like earned in a sense. There's a big climactic confrontation that is framed just like any other finale in a Lovecraftian story, except for once you end up rooting for the coldest in a way, the person.
Well, it's so personal.
Yes.
Like that's like the greatest success I think of this story is giving, especially in the inversion and the commentary on Lovecraft as a racist author, is giving so much personal motivation to this main character so that when they make their turns, they do exactly as you're saying, Austin, where like you not only understand, but you root and say, yeah, fuck it, man. Like, go for it. Like, do your thing. And he does some, like, truly, both on a smaller scale, like on a personal violence scale. Like, the thing he does with the knife.
It's a lot.
Make sure, hey, man, you're going to be seeing. Uh-huh. You can't unsee anymore.
You can't close your eyes when you want to. Yeah.
Whew.
Oh, it's good.
Yeah. Uh-huh. It's but like,
try
it's,
to
it's,
shut it's, them it's, now, he says. Yeah.
It's so effective on, like, so many different levels that, like, I was both cackling and also revolted at the same time, that it just, like, the amount of mixed emotions, the amount of, the amount it imbues in the, it's not violence for violence sake. Like, it's a very personal violence in a way that is earned by the whole arc of the story that I just found to be, like, very profoundly revealing and, in a way that I was not expecting. Like, the way it all comes together and ends in that one room is just really something else.
Sorry, go on.
Well, yeah, I was just going to say, like, that feels like, you know, the point, and this is speaking to a little bit of what you said earlier, Austin, of there's this one line in the book that is a fear of cosmic indifference suddenly seemed comical, downright naive, mm-hmm. and then later says, what was indifference compared to malice? And it is, like, I feel like so much of the story is about transposing that fear of malice onto,
yeah,
mm-hmm. like the very thing that, like, refuses to consider it.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'm going to make you understand what it is like to move through the world where people hate you, and mm-hmm. where you don't have the luxury of being afraid of indifference.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's funny because that one could see that malice, like, acted upon Tom as indifference. Like, oh, Tom right. is just a rant, you know, in the sense that he is one of many.
Right.
In the sense that he is a black man.
Right, there's a sequence in which someone points to Tom to say, there's a cop who's like, bring me that guy.
Yeah.
And another cop just grabs a different black guy.
And then still...
And the guy, and he gets corrected, yeah.
He gets corrected and he still, like, pats him down and, like, checks his pockets.
Yeah.
Like, even though he's like, oh, no, it's not him. And he was like, well, I might as fucking well.
Yeah,
which
yeah,
is like, exactly. That is not indifference.
Right,
like,
right,
and I think it's, right. I think it's, like, easy for... to mistake that as indifference, and I think it's careless to do so, because that is malice disguised as indifference.
Totally. I guess, like, the my last thing here is to wrap back around to this question of tragedy and this question of community, because there's a version of this book that just ends on the repercussions of the big final act climax for the world and for the person who we read that line about not being able to shut your eyes now. But instead it wraps around to being about Tom and Tom's missed connection, not like Craigslist missed connection. RIP. To the rest of the diasporan community, right? Like the black diaspora is massive, and also did, you know, waves of black folk were brought from Africa across the Atlantic and deposited on shores that weren't ours. But we did not all arrive at once. And we arrived in many places, and slowly, as, you know, as chains were removed, were allowed some degree of movement. It's part of why Harlem is rendered so beautifully here, is that it ends up being a collection of so many different people who have finally found a place to mingle. And to mingle with people who historically they would not have mingled with often, right? Like, this is part of the thing with the Victoria Society, is in the time of the diaspora, new cultures had been born, new types of food. There is no one black culture. There's no one anything culture. And so – but there is a shared suffering. There is this thing that links them all together. There is this place where if only Tommy had – known was not this horrible vision that he had in his head that he peddled himself about what the Victoria Society was, he could have lived such a different life had that thing. Though not too different a life, right? Like, there is another character in this story, his friend Buckeye, who goes to the Victoria Society all the time, is known by name as Victoria Society, but still has suffered at the hands of malice, at the hands of white malice, that, like, he is a construction worker who shows up expecting to be able to get the same sort of job he got overseas building the Panama Canal, shows up in New York, is only able to you know, he's able to do construction work, but he's not protected by a union because he's not allowed to join the union. And when he's injured, he has no job security. He gets kicked out. When he comes back after healing,
he hurts his ankle.
He hurts his ankle. Yeah, he breaks
can't
his
put weight on
and
it.
And he can't put weight on it. And there's no one's like, oh, we'll help you get another job, or like, well, you can work limited hours or anything. Like, he's just gone. And so at that point, he turns to crime. Light crime. If I was like running, he's doing like numbers. He's doing like lotteries, right? Mm-hmm. He's doing like small time private lotteries. But he still has the Victoria Society. He still finds community, and so there's this great like tension there of, yes, the Victoria Society will provide you life and joy and some, you know, connection to others will still happen, but that won't be enough to dig you out of the pit by itself either. And yet still there is this tragic, you know, reminder at the end that. At some point, if Tommy had pushed himself to actually connect to those other people, he would not have walked the path he walked. But also, I don't know that anyone can leave this book sad he did, you know? Burn it all down.
Well, without getting into specifics of the epilogue is, like, really important for why the whole story even works for me. Because, like, so many of these, like, Lovecraft stories end with... Like, this movie does – the story doesn't end with, like, the world destruction, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there are implications, but the way it ends is, like, is the most satisfying part of, like, the whole thing for me, because it, like, reconsiders everything that came before it in a really satisfying way. I really love the epilogue to the story.
Me too.
Yeah. It was a terrific book. Really glad we took a look at it. Definitely want to read more from Laval.
They're doing a TV series, my understanding.
Oh, yeah, AMC is adapting it. Yeah, apparently. And now this makes me want to read Lovecraft Country, which I didn't know was based on a book.
Right.
So, like, the Jordan Peele's producing this HBO series about, like, Jim Crow America and a road trip and Lovecraftian something. But apparently, it's based on, like, a pretty scary book. And was recommended from a few folks. It's like, hey, if you want to see and read more material that, like, tries to recast and rethink about Lovecraft and his legacy in the narrative itself. Apparently that's also, like, an interesting Austin, you had – I just want to shout out because you linked it to us. There's a good Fresh Air interview, not with Terry Gross, but with one of the other interviewers there talking with the author, and gets a little more into, like, the backstory of, like, how as a Lovecraft was, like, formative. Like, they named, like, four authors: Stephen King, Clive Barker, Shirley Jackson, and H.P. Lovecraft is, like, the four foundational authors informing his work. And the different he gives this great answer about the difference between reading Lovecraft when he was, like, 8 and then reading Lovecraft when he was, like, 15, in which he explains how as a black child you could read Lovecraft and not understand, like, obviously an 8-year-old is not, but he walks you through, like, his own veil dropping on how do you deal with the fact that, like, how I look at writing and horror and the human condition is informed by someone that I now realize was deeply othering me in the work that I was admiring. It's just really a fascinating sort of look into what informed the writing of the book too.
And there'll be a link to that in the show notes, which will probably also be extensive once again this week. Anyway, that will do it for Waypoints. Our thanks to Tumelo for the track Slide Asleep off the album After Midnight. You can find that at tumelomakes.bandcamp.com, and you can keep up with all of us at Waypoint at waypoint.vice.com. I'm Rob Zachney, and you can find me on Twitter at Rob Zachney. Patrick, where can people find you?
At Patrick Lubbock.
Danielle.
At Danielle R.I.
Austin.
Austin_Walker.
Natalie.
At Natalie Watson.
All right. Well, that will conclude this week's Waypoints. We hope you've enjoyed the break. We'll be back again. Well, it's a holiday week, so I'm not 100% certain what the schedule is going to be. Probably the next thing you're going to be hearing is a Waypoint radio of some sort or another. But either way, I hope you'll join us again. Until then, do not give in to astonishment.
Live streams, short form video. In 2019, we really want to push the envelope and figure out some new dynamics. And so, just, you know what? I'm going to let the content speak for itself. Play.
Hi, I'm Natalie Crunch Crunch. I am here to eat carrots.
So, what do you all think?
Talk to you about video Crunch 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 games.
Well, I love it. We've been looking for a way to sort of put our own spin on pivoting content strategies. And I feel like, you know, we master of the two screens, right? The second screen.
Yep.
We've got
screen.
The TV that we're pursuing. But then also, people are freaks. And
Gen
we need
Z,
to...
we've looked, we've indexed. Gen Z over indexes.
Believe in the youth.
Believe in the youth. Gen Z over indexes for being freaks. It says that they are 72% being freaks. Gen Y, only 62%.
And the thing is, this, like, I can see this scales. Like, think of how many videos of carrots we can get, but what else can Natalie Crunch Crunch crunch?
I mean, think of all the types of carrots out there.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.